and is director who have helped us a lot through the organization of the meeting. And I have only just a little disappointment because I am really very impressed by PIMS. I was here just before it was created. And after 4 years, it's impressive how many things they are doing. And I really thought that Nasif has an infinite power to organize things and convince people and get money and all these things. And so I have a little, not complaint, but disappointment, because you weren't able to convince the mayor of Vancouver to end the bus strike. Okay, so I'm going to speak about linear Dirac problems in these lectures. And the nonlinear part will be taken care of by Eric Serre afterwards. So these problems arise in modeling of in electrodynamics. That is, one wants to describe the dynamics of electrons which are moving under the effect of external electromagnetic fields. And we want to take into account all kinds of relativistic effects which can arise, for example, when we are thinking of atoms which are in atoms or molecules, and we have in the atoms nuclei which are heavy, then the speeds of the electrons which are in the inner layers are quite high. And so neglecting relativistic effects is not really a very good idea. In particular, we are looking for states, what is called bound states of the electrons, which means that we are looking for solutions of the evolution equations which have the following form, e to the minus I omega x0 psi of x. And by x0 I mean time, so it's t usually. And by x I mean space variables, x1, x2, x3. So we are in R3. So we are looking for solutions of evolution problem which have this this shape, and we are looking for we are not looking for an equation. I'm going to describe some equations. So the usual way of writing these equations is in the following way, something like the Schrödinger equation. So we are looking for solutions of this kind with bars, for example, h psi in R plus times R3. And well, we are using quantum mechanics to look at this kind of equations when H is the Schrödinger operator minus Laplace with some constant, maybe some potential. But in the 20s, when Dirac found his operator, there was a list of requirements to take into account to make a model which was compatible with relativity. So the list of requirements were the following. First, he was looking for an operator of Hamiltonian H such that the equation was invariant under the Lorentz group. I'm not going to give details about this, but it's a group of transformations, so Lorentz invariants. Second one is that the equation should be the same order of derivatives in time and space, because in relativity, time and space play more or less the same kind of role. So it's, since we have first order in T, he was looking for a first order operator in space, so first order operator. He was looking also for a differential operator, and not pseudo-differential in the to be compatible with the causality principle in relativity. And one of the last requirements is to fulfill, to be able to fulfill the relation between the very well-known Einstein's relation between energy, mass, and momentum. And it's the following thing. The energy square is equal to the mass of the particle to the square. C to the force is the speed of light, plus C square, momentum square. Okay, and this, in terms of the operator, means that the operator should be equal to m, to this constant times the identity, minus c square Planck's constant square Laplace, because we just are using the usual relation, and the momentum is equal to minus A H bar C nabla. Okay? So he was looking for something like this. So this is a list of things we have to satisfy. And algebraically, it's quite easy to look for an operator which satisfies all these assumptions. And the simplest one is the following one, that is called now the Dirac operator. So I'm going to write first the Dirac operator with in time and space. So I'm going to write it with a bar on top of it. So it's minus I C H. Okay, so what are these things? Well, I is the constant, the complex constant I. C is the speed of light, it's a positive constant, quite large. H bar is Planck's constant, which is a constant positive, which is very small. And the alphas and betas are matrices which are 4 by 4 matrices. So when I write bars here, I am thinking in time and space. So it's 4. Here I have alpha 0, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3. And here I have beta. So all these matrices are 4 by 4 complex matrices with constant coefficients. Just to give you an idea, alpha 0 is the identity, beta is minus 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, minus 1, and I am writing a 4 by 4 matrix with 2 by 2 blocks, so this is the identity in 2 by 2. And the alpha i's, the other ones, are equal to 0, sigma I, 0. These sigma i's are the so-called polymatrices. I'm not writing them in detail. They are constant coefficient matrices, 2 by 2. And they were found just to ensure that this equality is satisfied. Here. And so this is the simplest, algebraically, this is the simplest first-order operator for which we have all these requirements satisfied. And he had really to work with these matrices, 4 by 4 matrices. This is the minimal dimension you can have in order to ensure all these things when m is larger than 0, when you have a positive mass. It's an easy algebraic exercise. If m were equal to 0, then one can realize an operator with 2 by 2 matrices. Okay. So this is the so-called Dirac operator. And say that since the matrices are 4 by 4, this means that the functions on which it's going to act are not scalars, like in the case of the Schrödinger operator we are used to. So here the vectors, the solutions we are going to look at, are functions which are defined in R3 and take values in C4. They are vectors. They are called 4 spinors. And very often in my lectures, I will actually describe these spinors in a different way. I will talk about them, I will decompose them in the so-called upper and lower spinor. And these upper and lower spinors are functions which go from R3 into C2. We will see that it helps a lot to use this description like this. Okay. Something which is quite easy to compute and which is important for all the things I'm going to talk about is the fact that one can compute very easily the spectrum of... Well, no, before I go into that, let me just say that if we are looking for bound states, okay, we are looking for bound states, well, I can actually, since I have some constants, I can look for solutions. For example, if I have the equation, if I want to solve, for example, and I have an external potential which depends only on x, for example, and I want to solve this equation equal to 0, then if psi bar is going to be something like a bound state, and to get rid of the constants, I'm going to take psi bar bound state to be E minus I, so I take omega CH bar x0 psi of x. So I plug this function into this equation, and I see that this function, this bound state, is solution of this equation if and only if the corresponding psi here is an eigenfunction of some operator. So this is equivalent to solving H0 plus V psi equal to omega psi in R3. So I got rid of time by looking for bound states. And we see that, well, it's quite classical, that looking for bound states for this kind of linear evolution equation is equivalent to looking for eigenfunctions and eigenvalues of some equation in which there is no stationary equation, there is no time anymore. Okay, so we want this is a little bit a motivation, to look for this kind of linear Dirac problems. Okay, so we are going to be interested in looking at these kind of equations. So when I write H0 without bar now, I hope it's not mine. So when I write the operator now without bar, I'm just getting rid of time. So it's like, so when I have H0 without bars, everything is without bars. And so I'm just looking, this now is the usual nabla, so I'm just looking at x variables x1, x2, x3, okay? So I forget about alpha 0 now. Okay, so this is the Dirac operator. And in most of the cases, not all the time, I can choose units in which I get rid of the constants. So in some of my, in part of my lectures, I will choose units in which I make all the constants equal to 1. I can do it by choosing a right change of variables. And in some cases, because I'm going to speak a little bit about the non-relativistic limit in which z goes to infinity, in that case, when I am going to look about the non-relativistic limit, of course I want to play with z, so I can't make z equal to 1 and then say that z goes to infinity. So in that case, I will just keep z, and I will make always m equal to h bar equal to 1. Just for simplicity, nothing changes, but it's just not to be taking care of all those constants all the time. So one thing which is very easy to compute is the spectrum of this operator H0. So it's just in Fourier variables, it's just an easy algebraic exercise. And when you compute it, I am going to be now in the case, well, I will keep C almost all the time because, well, when you compute the spectrum of this operator, you see that this spectrum is just only essential spectrum. And it's made of the union of two intervals, unbounded intervals. You have minus infinity minus C squared. And then C squared plus infinity. In the cases in which I will make C equal to 1, it will be minus 1 and 1 here. So I have this spectrum, which means that the spectrum is unbounded below and above, and I have a gap between minus C squared and C squared in the spectrum. So I have an operator with a gap in the spectrum. Okay? And if I am interested in bound states which have some kind of stability, I will be interested in solving this equation here for psi different from 0, of course, and for omegas, which are in the gap of the essential spectrum, if I want to have some stability for the bound states. Okay? So the main question is to be able to find eigenvalues, omegas, which lie in the gap here, between minus C squared and C squared. And actually, the final aim of this series of lectures is to give, to see the application of an after result. So before I forget it, this is all joint work with Jean Dolbeau and Eric Serre, both my colleagues in Dauphine. And so what we, our final aim was to prove actually, we proved an abstract result, general abstract result, which is optimal in some sense, which deals with general self-adjoint operators, with gaps in the essential spectrum. And by general, I mean that, for example, I will apply this result to the case of Dirac operators, but for example, it can be applied to Schrödinger operators with periodic potentials, in which cases you create gaps in the essential spectrum. It's a general result which allows us to find a way to describe how to describe the eigenvalues in the gaps of the essential spectrum. Okay? This is not variational, it's not clear matter how to do it at the beginning. Okay? So we have a general result, and then I will apply in the case, particular case of Dirac operators. Okay. So I think that many people who are in the audience have heard me speaking about these kind of problems in the past, because this is a long program. We've been working with Eric Serre. We started around 95, working these kind of problems. And I think that many people here have had different stages of this of these results. So we had, first we started actually looking at nonlinear Dirac problems. Then we realized that in the meantime we needed some results about the linearized equations. We looked in the literature and we didn't find any result, or not many results about this kind of linear problems. There were only qualitative results in the theoretical physics literature. And so we came to the linear problems later, which is strange. In general, it's just the opposite. And so there have been different stages of our approach to these problems. In particular, already in 95, with Eric, we gave already a variational characterization of eigenvalues for the Dirac operators in the gap of the essential spectrum. And, there have been different stages afterwards. And this latest result that we have found, which is general optimal in some sense, I will explain in which sense it's optimal, is something which has been published in Journal of Functional Analysis in 2000. And, if I have time, in the last lecture, I will speak also about the fact that the disaster result gives us a way to deal with not only mathematical theorems to describe the eigenvalues, but also gives us a way to compute them numerically, which is not an easy way. I hope I will have 10-15 minutes in the last lecture to speak about that. It's not easy to compute the eigenvalues numerically if you don't have the right way of looking at that. And so this new way of looking at the problem gives us a way to solve it numerically, probably, avoiding some difficulties that the physicists had to compute these eigenvalues. And we made some computations quite naive, in naive context, and this was published in Physical Review Letters in 2000. So I will show some tables and some numerical results. Very elementary, but at least to give an idea of how things work. Okay, so this is the program. So actually, I'm going to begin. Before I start with some more concrete mathematics, let me say that there are other people working in this area. So the first result, probably about the variational characterization of eigenvalues in the gap for the Dirac operators, it was in 95, so it was a work of Eric Serre and myself. And then, I think it was in 98, there was a quite interesting work by Grissemer and Sidentop, I don't remember, I think it's 98, 90. And it was quite interesting because they used a very different approach to this problem. And they were using, in our first work, were using very naive direct, I will describe them tomorrow, techniques which are variational, very direct, just analysis. And in this work, they were using many tools of spectral theory, abstract theory. And it was actually quite interesting because the result was covered fewer cases, as I mean, if we look at potentials which can be taken care of, we'll speak about hypotheses later, they could cover fewer cases than ours. But it was a different way of looking at things, and it helped us actually a lot to get our final result. So it was quite important for us. And so there was also further resolved by ourselves with Jean Dolbeau later on, improving the assumptions of our first work. I think it was in 1999 also there was an improvement of the result of Grissemer and Sidentop by Grissemer, Lewis and Sidentop. It was 99 also. And then we published in 2000 this result, which really is optimal. If we look at the assumptions asked to the potentials, it's optimal in some sense. But we used ideas which were introduced by Grissemer and Sidentop in their paper. Okay. So, as I said before, Dirac proposed this operator, and this operator is a little bit, well, I don't want to get a lot into physics first because I don't know enough, and I'm afraid there are some people here who know more than me, and I don't want to make mistakes, but just to tell you that when Dirac proposed this operator, there was in some sense a lot of problems because he had to explain which he had to give a sense to the fact that in his problem he has particles between quotes with negative and positive energies, and that was a strange thing, and he elaborated on that and he came out with what is called the Hall theory in some sense. Yes, I don't want to explain that, but he was actually able to define anti-electrons, anti-matter, before they were seen, observed. So, in some sense, he identified, it's a way to identify the negative energies with the positrons, which are the anti-electrons, which have positive charge. Okay, so I don't want to go into that, but just to say that there was a big discussion in physics about the Dirac operator because of the existence of these negative energies. People said, what is it? So he used those negative energies in some sense to define the positrons before they were discovered. He proposed this explanation. The fact that we have these negative energies, so in physics there was a problem because of them, but also in mathematics, as we will see, they pose a big problem because we have to define these eigenvalues in the gap, and so we can't use the usual trick of looking at the Rayleigh quotient and minimizing the Rayleigh quotient to get the first eigenvalue. We can't do that here because we have these negative energies, and so the Rayleigh quotient is not bounded below. So mathematically also, the fact that the Dirac operator is not bounded below or above creates many problems. So there are people who try to avoid the existence of these negative energies and this unboundedness from below. And so in many papers in theoretical physics in which the word relativistic appears, other operators than Dirac operator appear. For example, in the 70s, 80s, there is work about modeling atoms and molecules, relativistic, and no Dirac operator exists in those papers. And the operator which is used in those papers is the so-called Herbst operator, which is the modulus of the momentum. Okay, so this is a bounded below operator because it's non-negative. And so this is an approximation of Dirac. And there have been different attempts later on of constructing other operators which are bounded below and which are not so far away from Dirac operator. For example, I will define another one later on. I don't want to get into technical details now, but I will describe later on what is called the Brown-Ravenhall operator, which was actually defined as such around 97-98 in this group of people working around Grissemer and Sidentop. And so it's another approximation of the Dirac operator, which is bounded below. So I will speak about that later, and I will define it later. Okay, so now let me say something about why one has to use this kind of operators when looking at electrons, for example, in atoms or molecules, where we are using quantum mechanics in causes in quantum mechanics to be using all the time the Schrödinger operator. So why now the Dirac operator? Well, as I told you before, the Dirac operator or other kind of operators have to be introduced when one doesn't want to neglect the relativistic effects, the very high velocities of the electrons. But I want to show that actually the Schrödinger operation is the Schrödinger equation is really a very good equation, and actually we are not losing a lot of information when looking at it instead of looking at other type of equations. So what I'm going to speak about is also the so-called non-relativistic limit. It tells us in which sense the Dirac operator is very close to the Schrödinger operator. So when the speeds of the electrons are not very high, working with the Schrödinger operation is quite acceptable, and we don't make very many mistakes, and it's much easier because the Schrödinger operator is bounded below, so it's much easier mathematically, etc. So I'm going to speak in some sense in which sense the Dirac operator, depending on C, is not very far away from the Schrödinger operator plus, actually we have to shift some of the energies C square. So I'm going to speak about that also. So since, and this is more or less, well, I will say which sense this is true, more or less, when C is large. So mathematically, we have to pass to the limit when C is large. But physically, we know that the speed of light is quite light. It's quite big. So that's why the Schrödinger operator gives very good approximation. And only when the speed of the electrons in very heavy atoms, we really make, one makes mistakes when looking only at the inner layers of the atoms. Even the outer layers don't feel very much. They don't go very. The electrons in the outer layers don't feel very much this heaviness, and so the speeds are okay, and one can model them with the Schrödinger operator. So it's only in the inner layers that there are the errors, which are quite important, if one takes the Schrödinger operator to describe them. And so there are two schools actually of people. There are people who want to compute energies, binding energies, or eigenvalues, these kind of things. There are two kinds of schools. There are the people who make computations, non-relativistic computations. Non-relativistic means, well, we can think about Schrödinger, or Pauli equation, other equations, Pauli equation. And then they make relativistic corrections. So they have some models of what are the next terms in some kind of expansion. So this is one of the schools of people who make computations. So they prefer to make the computations in the case in which things are bounded below, the computing of the eigenvalues is much safer in the computer, there is no bad surprises, and then they try to guess some models, they try to find some good models to see what the relativistic correction should be. So this is one of the possible directions. And the second kind of groups of people are people who do directly relativistic computations. And these people who are doing this computation more than physicists, I would say, is called quantum chemistry. It's physics, chemistry. So there are people who are trying to compute big molecules and these kind of things. And we've been talking with people who are doing these kind of computations, and they say that actually they have difficulties. I will explain why tomorrow, the day after. They have difficulties in computing directly with the Dirac operator, for example, but the cost of the computations is not so much, maybe it's double or triple than doing this. So there are different codes, numerical codes now, which are in competition, and in both cases, well, it depends on the situation, it's better to do the first thing or the second thing. But mathematically, it's quite different to do one or the other. Okay, so now I am... I don't know when I started, I didn't look at the watch.
You have 18 minutes.
Okay. So, so I'm going to speak now about more precise mathematics. I think I'm going to try to show to you now why the Dirac operator and the Schrödinger operator are very close. By actually, in the linear case, it's quite easy to show it. So what I'm going to explain in detail is the non-relativistic limit. I think that Eric in his lectures will need a little bit. He will speak a little bit about the non-relativistic limit in the non-linear case. In the non-linear case, the computations are much more involved. So I think that here in this case we can see really very well why the Dirac operator is very close to the Schrödinger operator, and in which sense, because it's not just directly. So as I said before, in some sense I am going to show to you that the Dirac operator shifted by a constant minus C squared is in some sense close to minus Laplacian over 2. Okay, so when C is large, so when the speeds are not very high, choosing this operator gives a good approximation of the Dirac operator. And so we are going, we can do it very easily, I think in 10 minutes, so let me explain how it works. And we see quite well in which sense, in this quote, what is the meaning of this quote. So in order to prove that, I'm going to write the equation which I want to look at. So I have this equation depending on C. So imagine that I have eigenvalues, eigenfunctions, everything is depending on C. And I want to pass to the limit. In which sense I pass to the limit? And in which sense I'm going to find an equation which is quite different? Because you see, it's strange. Here I am starting from an operator which is not bounded below. And I'm going to show to you that it's close to an operator which is bounded below. So it's strange in which sense. Okay, so I'm going to write that equation equivalently. And the computations I'm going to do, the computations I am going to do in a very easy case, just not to, it's not necessary, but just to make things clear here. I'm going to consider cases in which we have negative potentials, which means attractive potentials physically, which is the case, for example, if I am looking at an atom, the potential, the electron's field, the nuclear potential is negative everywhere. If I make some simplifications, so I'm going just, it's not necessary, just to give you the general idea, I'm going to consider attractive potentials, which go to zero at infinity. So these are things which are reasonable physically when we are looking at the atom. And I'm going to write this equation as a system using, as what I told you before, I'm going to write the spinors in terms of the upper spinor and the lower spinor. This is quite a useful thing done in physics all the time because it allows to see some things which are not easy to see in the equation here. So in a matrix form, this operator is the following, right, the following, is a matrix operator. So I have V plus C squared. I have V minus C squared. This is an easy computation. Just looking at the matrices, the alpha matrices here, the matrix beta here, and the polymatrices. So just taking into account these definitions, this operator is a matrix operator, acting on functions with two components. So I have this. And here I have CL. And I call L the operator minus I C. No, no C because I took the C out. Sigma dot nabla. And the sigmas are the polymatrices. Okay, so this is just another way of writing the operator. And I write it like this because I'm going to decompose the spinors in the upper and lower component. So I want to decompose the action of the operator on the upper and lower component. And so it's quite easy to see. So I just apply this to psi, which is a vector phi chi. And I see that this equation is equivalent to the following system, C L chi plus C square plus B phi equal, I call it omega phi. And the second equation is C L phi plus minus C square plus B chi equal to omega chi. So this is just writing using the matrix definition for the operator. And just in order to see things clearly, I'm going to make a shift in the spectrum, which is related to this shift here. So I'm just going to write omega. So omega, I want omega to be something which lives in the gap. So between minus C square, I'm just shifting it, the C square to zero. So I'm just going to write that omega is equal to mu plus C square, with some mu, which lives now in the interval, minus 2 C square, zero. Okay? Just a question of notation. So I'm going to write here mu plus C square, and here also. It's really very elementary computations. And then from the second equation, I see that I get the following thing, that C L phi is equal to mu plus 2 C square minus V chi. This is from the second equation. And then you see, if I am looking at mu's which live between minus 2 C square and 0, mu plus 2 C square is positive. I was making the assumption to simplify that V was non-negative. Okay, so all this is something, it's a function which is always positive and never equal to 0. So I have something here which is never equal to 0, so I can divide by it. Okay, so this is just all formal. So I can write that chi is equal to C L phi divided by the function mu plus 2 C square minus B. So I can write the lower spinor as a function of the upper spinor. And now I use this in the first equation. Okay. So I use it in the first equation, and what I get is the following thing. I get C square L square L phi over mu plus 2 C square minus V plus V phi equal to mu phi. And you see that I got rid of the lower spinor. I just wrote now an equation for phi. There is no chi here. And it's going to be a second order equation for phi, because L is an operator which is first order. And I'm going to take here its square. So it's going to be a second order equation for phi. And actually, I just can make little computation with the matrices to see that L square is equal to minus C square Laplace. It's an easy computation. So I can write that equation in the following way. I have here the derivatives, so I have to differentiate this quotient here. So I'm going to get the following equation. Not the minus C square. There is no C square because L, there was no constant C in L. I took it out. So the equation, this equation I can write in the following way. Minus C square Laplacian phi divided by mu plus 2 C square minus B plus B phi, I have to differentiate the denominator, so I get minus, I get plus C square L phi L V scalar product mu plus 2 C square minus B to the square plus B phi equal to mu phi. So I get this second order equation for phi. It's equivalent under my hypothesis to the linear eigenvalue equation here. Okay? And I see the following thing. I had no time to give to make a rigorous proof of this. But you can see already formally that if I take C to be large, and I look at the orders of C's I have in the different terms, I have these last terms here in which there is no C. In the first term, you see that I have C square up upstairs and downstairs. So if I pass to the limit formally, I mean, I can do it rigorously if I make the right assumptions, but I don't have time to do that. So formally, if I pass to the limit here, what I get is minor Laplacian phi divided by 2. And in the second term, I see that if the functions are okay, bounded, uniformly in some space, I see that I have upstairs, I have c squared, and downstairs, I have c to the 4. So this is something which is O of 1 over C squared, if things are okay, because of course all these functions depend on C. So I have to be able to prove that I have bounds, a priori estimates, on the functions phi C in some nice Sobolev spaces. Okay, but that can be done. But formally I have this, plus V phi equal to lambda phi, mu phi, excuse me. And so you see that if things are okay, if I have the right a priori estimates in the right Sobolev spaces, I will be able to pass to the limit. So I have things which depend on C here. If I am able to pass to the limit in some sense, I see that the limit of the phi C's, if I am able to find estimates and pass to the limit maybe weakly at the beginning, and then so I extract a subsequence which converges weakly to something, etc., etc., I have to prove that this thing is different from the zero function. I mean, there is some analysis to be done. And then, if everything works fine, we see that we can pass to the limit here, and we recover for the limit function the equation minus Laplacian phi bar plus v phi bar equal to mu phi bar for some mu which is negative. Okay? And it's then not so difficult to see that if with the same assumptions I erase the expression of chi as a function of phi, but I have the following thing. Chi was equal to CL phi over mu plus 2C squared minus V. So we see that here, if everything is fine, I have C here, C squared in the denominator. So this is a function which is big O of 1 over C. Okay? So what I find in the end is that I started with eigenfunctions psi c, okay, corresponding to eigenvalues lambda c of the Dirac operator H0 plus V. And if I get all the a priori estimates that I need and do some analysis, I can pass to the limit, and what I see is that the psi c converges not, well, in some sense, not to an eigenfunction of the, there is a 2 over here. So not to an eigenfunction of the Schrödinger operator, but what happens is that the upper spinor converges to a solution of this equation. So it's an eigenfunction of the Schrödinger operator, and the lower spinor goes to 0. Okay? And this is, in some sense, the fact that we lose, the lower spinor converges to 0, is a thing which allows us to relate an operator which is unbounded below with an operator which is bounded below. It's the fact that not the whole eigenfunction converges to an eigenfunction of the Schrödinger operator. That would be completely impossible. It's the fact that actually only the upper spinor converges to an eigenfunction of the Schrödinger operator, and the lower spinor, when the speed of light is very, very large, it converges to 0. Okay, so in this sense, in which we can say, so this is the quads, the mean of the quads, that A0C minus C squared is close to minus Laplacian over 2 when C goes to plus infinity. In this sense, it's in the sense that the upper parts of the vector converge to eigenfunctions of this one plus the potential, and the lower part disappears. Okay, so this is just to relate a little bit the non-relativistic and the relativistic case, because in the nonlinear case, I think that Eric will explain that this non-relativistic limit is quite important for us to define a notion of ground state for some models, for nonlinear models for atoms and molecules. So at least in the linear case, we've seen a little bit very easily that formally it's very easy to see how they relate both equations. And tomorrow I will continue speaking about how to define the eigenvalues of this kind of operators in gaps. So tomorrow what I will do is first speak about some technicalities which are fundamental in the analysis of these problems, which are related to hard inequalities, hard type inequalities. So we have to see in which sense, when we want to analyze the spectrum of H0 plus V, so we want to find eigenfunctions of H and eigenvalues of H0 plus V, and we want to find the eigenvalues in the gap, in some sense we have to be able to define variationally that in a good way. We have to be able to compare H0 with V to control. And so this is something which is related to some hard inequalities of different types. I will give you a list of different hard inequalities that are relevant in the case of Dirac operators. And then tomorrow I will continue by giving a variational characterization of eigenvalues in the gap by using these hard type inequalities. And then at the end of tomorrow and in the third lecture, I will state the general abstract result for defining eigenvalues of operators with gaps, and I will apply this abstract result to the Dirac operator to see how to find the eigenvalues. And I have to say that the first result I will state tomorrow is a completely variational result, in the sense that we will characterize the eigenvalues by some min-max approach. But if we do that directly, as we did it at the beginning with Jean Dolbeau and Eric Serret, we see that actually by doing that we don't reach the optimal results that we know in some particular cases. In some particular cases the problems can be solved explicitly by using special functions. And so by using direct min-max approaches, we were unable, I will show you why, it's related to the hard inequalities, why it doesn't give the right optimal result. And I will show you, so in the last lecture, that by mixing this variational approach with some continuation principle plus some abstract spectral theory, we can really reach the optimal result, and then see, come back to the Dirac problem, and in that case, see what kind of hard inequalities derive from this optimal result. So there is a very, very strong link between hard inequalities and solving these linear Dirac problems. Okay, thank you.
It's clear in the non-relativistic limit that you can state conditions on V so that mu is greater than minus 2c squared. It looks more complicated, though, in the relativistic case. It evidently will involve derivatives of V. Can you reach reasonable conditions on V?
No, we don't give in our result. We don't give conditions on the derivatives. Only on the on how bad the singularities of the potentials are. So they have to be of at worst like Coulomb type potentials at the singularities, and they have to go to zeros at infinity, and we have to measure a little bit. We don't need that V is negative, as I said. We don't need that the potential is attractive everywhere. For example, in molecules is not the case, but we have to give an assumption on how large, it hasn't to be very large, the positive part of the potential is. But we don't make assumptions in our result about derivatives of P. I will leave precise assumptions tomorrow.
Those assumptions are the ones that guarantee that the limit eigenvalues.
Yes, because I was saying that I divide by this, so I was needing that V is negative and all that. Actually, you can have that V is positive somewhere, but in those places, mu is below 2c squared enough to compensate. So.
But what I was saying is the assumption that you make on the potential are those so that the limit to the Schrödinger operator admits eigenvalue, but you don't.
No, it's much less. No, because for the Schrödinger operator, you can have singularities up to 1 over x squared because of homogeneity. And for the Dirac operator, the maximal singularity you can have is types 1 over x. Then you have to say something about the constant you put here, the optimal constant you put here. So for the Dirac operator, this is the maximal singularity you can have because you have to compare, you have to control the potential energy by the, in some sense, by the kinetic energy. And by homogeneity, this is first order, you can't put more than 1 over x as singularity. But this is okay because in the models for atoms and molecules, this kind of singularity you find. So it's okay in the physical case.
Is it possible to think naively, from the point of view of quantum electrodynamics essentially, that the velocity, the potential, your conditions are such that electron has not enough energy to create a pair?
Well, no.
No?
No, you can have pairs, but I don't want to go into that. All these models, in these models we are, in this model I am looking at, and in the models Eric Serre will speak about, which are Dirac-Fock models, we fix the number of particles. So we fix the number of electrons, so there is no pair. In cases in which you have creation of pair possible in quantum electrodynamics or quantum field theory, you fix the charge, but you don't fix the number of particles. But those are models which are much more complicated, and we don't look at those. Though we think, I mean, there is something in progress, which is maybe there is a link between the kind of models we use and the kind of models one can extract from quantum field theory, in which you have something which is bounded below. And there is a project between us and people like Sidentop, Bach, Helfer, and Barbaru, who are trying to obtain some result for functional in quantum field theory, in which they have pairs. We don't have pairs, but it seems that maybe what we are looking at is the same thing in the end, because they don't have pairs for the minimizing sequences. But that's a quite tough question. So in our case, no pairs.
I want to ask you the following thing. Can you interpret the lower spin off as the probability density of an anti-positron? And also, the theoretical question. There is a way to take the limit and to get a kind of Schrödinger equation for the lower spin off.
I mean, when we write things rigorously, you see exactly how the lower spin off goes to zero.
Yeah, but can you interpret as the probability of the
has to be
very
limit, because if you
know. No, I don't think so. No, because to be speaking of positrons, we are speaking of electrons here in the end. I mean, we deal with negative energies, but we are speaking of electrons. Okay. In order to have to be speaking of positrons, what happens is that we have this this spectrum here, and we want to see that the potential we put there is able to create some eigenvalues, but they come in, they are taken out of the essential spectrum from the right. And those are going to correspond to electronic states. But in cases in which you want to model positrons, which you can do just by reverse the charge, it's the opposite. You will have potentials which are positive enough to create some eigenvalues coming from the left. So we are speaking about different. We are speaking about electrons, really.
But that is not that we can out that psi bar will go to zero and high, and eventually high bar will go to something different from zero.
No, it goes to zero because when C is large, we are reaching a non-relativistic regime in which there is no positronic part. So this is quite coherent. The electrons have some positronic component, but it's very small when C is large. I mean, you can't get rid, when you use the Hertz operator, you are getting rid, for example, of the negative energies. You are making some error by doing that. What we see here clearly is that the eigenfunctions contain, in some sense, they have positive energies, but they have a little positronic component, but which is very small when C is large. They are electrons, really.
And in fact, if this is the case, this component is just high, it goes to zero.
Yes, it goes to zero.
And so it's correct to say that high is the positron component of your
spin. Yes, which is quite small.
Yeah.
they can describe positrons in some sense.
I'd like to thank our speaker again, and thank you.